Blog Talk Radio.
To tap in the Arkansas Paranormal Network, coming to you from Van Buren, Arkansas. Hope everybody's having a good weekend. We are having a wet, semi-snowy weekend here, so it's raining now, just above freezing, so it's kind of raining. Higher elevations are getting snow, and we're expected to have a little bit of snow for ourselves tonight here at the studios and everywhere, so I kind of was doing a little, did show a little early tonight, and so, hey, that way I can get in out of here before the weather kicks in. So, tonight we are going to, since it's the Christmas season, which is only a couple of weeks away, guys, and it's not that far away. So, hey, we are, some of us are looking forward to it, some of us, you know, it's kind of tough for us right now. We moving, packing, moving, stuff like that. Anyway, I mean, not the studios, not down here. So, not where we're at. Where we live at. So, anyway, there's nothing to announce for right now. We just want to get on here and do this. It's called The History of Behind Santa Claus. So, we'll see how this runs, and hope everybody enjoys the show.
Hello, I'm Jack Perkins. Welcome to Biography. Father Christmas, Old Saint Nick, Kris Kringle, these are some of the names given to the man anxiously awaited every December 24, the night before Christmas. We all know him as Santa Claus. What we sometimes forget is that this jolly old elf who sneaks down the chimney every year has a history more than 1,700 years old, a tradition that spans the globe. He started as a bishop in Turkey, famed for his generosity to those in trouble. He was beloved patron saint of Europe who sailed to America with the Dutch. Once here, he transformed from Saint Nicholas to Santa Claus, a gentleman synonymous with Christmas, with bringing families together, with filling children with anticipation, and of course, with helping to sell a lot of products around December 25. Join us as we take a look back across hundreds of years to trace the extraordinary history of Santa Claus.
Merry Christmas, everybody!
You better watch out, you better not cry, you better not pout, I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town, gather round.
He has a big list and a telescope.
He goes to the chimney. Mommy and Daddy stay downstairs and give him cookies.
A red suit, flying reindeer, ho ho ho. These are the well-known particulars of Santa Claus, alias Father Christmas, Old Saint Nick, Kris Kringle. But who is he, and where did he come from? Well, he's taken a long journey from 3rd century Turkey to medieval France, and finally to every department store in America.
You better watch out, you better not cry, you better not cry, I'm telling you why.
Santa Claus is coming. You mean the big fat man with a long white beard? He's coming to town.
He now seems timeless. But in fact, Santa has a long and surprisingly colorful past. The story begins some 1,700 years ago, in the heart of the Roman Empire, in a town in Turkey called Patara. There, a real-life boy named Nicholas was born to wealthy Christian parents who had tried to have a child for years. And right from the start, the boy was remarkably holy. Wednesdays and Fridays were fast days for Christians. On these days, it is said little Nicholas would only nurse after sundown.
He was, as a baby, precocious. He was able to stand up in his little bassinet early on. These, you know, little touches, legendary touches, are all very charming. We don't know them as historical fact because nobody was around to take videotapes, you know, of a little, little Nicky.
The holy young man quickly rose from deacon to local priest. When he was 30 years old, the local diocese of Myra needed a new leader. The outgoing bishop received a sign from God about Nicholas.
That night, that very righteous bishop saw an image of a man at the back of the church. His face was like transfigured. He was bright like the sun. And he asked, "Who am I seeing? Who is this?" And he heard an angel say to him, "This is the next bishop that you should elect for Myra. His name is Nicholas."
Sure enough, Nicholas became the Bishop of Myra. And it is as the bishop that he earned a worldwide reputation as a righter of wrongs, a protector of the innocent. One early legend has Nicholas learning that a neighbor did not have a dowry for his oldest daughter. In the 4th century, this meant the girl would be sold off into prostitution or slavery. So Nicholas took some of his own family's gold, tied it into a handkerchief, and secretly dropped it through the neighbor's window. The girl was saved from her dreadful fate.
In many versions of the story, the gold landed in her stocking. You know, people would hang their socks out in front of the fireplace to dry. So this is where we get the idea of the gifts in the Christmas stocking.
When Nicholas repeated the gifts of gold for the neighbor's other two daughters, stories of his generosity began to spread. People spoke of his late-night anonymous gifts and his granting of secret wishes, just what the later Santa Claus would do. Nicholas was also gaining fame as a staunch defender of the faith, which he proved at an important early Christian council in Nicaea in 314.
The great element of St. Nicholas's presence at the Council of Nicaea is that it confirms his actual existence. There was a list of participants, and here was St. Nicholas of Myra present.
Led by Emperor Constantine, the council ceaselessly debated whether Christ was divine. Nicholas had no doubt of it, and he argued passionately. But one bishop refused to be moved by his arguments.
Nicholas, caught up in righteous anger, just couldn't find words anymore after months of meeting. So he just went up and he just slapped him. Everyone, of course, just looked and said, "Oh."
Protector of maidens, protector of the faith. The Bishop of Myra was soon called Saint Nicholas by those who heard of his miracles. And he was called upon by practically all who found themselves in trouble, lawyers and their clients, unmarried and childless women, and even pawnbrokers invoked this powerful figure. Sailors also called St. Nicholas their patron, believing he could appear from nowhere and calm a turbulent sea. But St. Nicholas achieved his greatest fame as the patron saint of the most vulnerable among us, children. In perhaps the most famous miracle associated with St. Nicholas, three students were on their way to school and were brutally kidnapped, robbed, and dismembered by an evil innkeeper. The innkeeper then stuffed the students' remains into empty pickle barrels. Well, suddenly, St. Nicholas appeared at the inn and commanded the boys to arise from the barrels. Slowly, miraculously, they emerged intact.
Here we have St. Nicholas, the beautiful patron saint of those otherwise lost and forgotten, never to be found children, who appears on the spot and piece by piece calls them out of the barrel and are brought back to life by the righteous St. Nicholas.
When Nicholas died on December 6, 343, his body was laid to rest in a tomb in Mira. Legend has it that the tomb began leaking a viscous liquid perfumed with myrrh, and that one drop of this liquid could heal the most troubling sickness.
People came there, blind, lame, people who suffered from all kinds of fevers, diseases. It was just as the scripture said. The blind see, the lame walk, the paralyzed are being freed. Then myrrh healed so many, many people.
The body of St. Nicholas was a holy treasure coveted by the entire Christian world. In 1082, during the Crusades, it was removed from Myra and taken to Bari, Italy by a band of sailors.
He was, in fact, snatched and kidnapped. But one man's snatching and kidnapping is another man's liberation. So he was taken to Bari, and there's a beautiful cathedral in Bari, which was built around St. Nicholas.
Each year, the residents of Bari restage the arrival of their most famous resident. The 11th century sailors of Bari carried stories of their miraculous Nicholas around the world, and the saint's promise of protection and mercy was irresistible. Saint Nick soon becomes the most popular saint of the Middle Ages, setting the stage for his next great transformation to Santa Claus.
Now, where does Santa Claus live?
North Pole.
North Pole.
His beard is white, his mustache is white, and his hair is white.
What does Santa look like?
He looks like Santa Claus.
The vast public appeal of the stories of St. Nicholas was largely religious, but mixed in were features of pagan gods and goddesses. The most important of these pagan gods was the German god Woden, pictured here as an 11th century statue. Woden, it was said, would pass judgment on a village by flying overhead and seeing whether the villagers were taking care of their family, their farms, their animals.
So we're starting to see already some elements that will come down to us in later pictures of St. Nicholas and many of the early pictures of Santa Claus. We have the mystical rider who comes through the sky and visits every home in the community. We have the judge who looks at your record for the whole year and decides whether you've been bad or good.
By combining the power of ancient gods like Woden with Christian miracles, St. Nicholas became an extraordinarily powerful and popular saint. By the Middle Ages, there were more churches named after this zealous crusader than there were for all the apostles put together.
St. Nicholas was enormously popular during the Middle Ages. He was the third figure in Christianity after Christ and the Mother of God. He was somebody you'd have around because you needed him. So he was a conduit to heaven. The most familiar, spokesman for your needs.
Inspired by his miracles and especially by his protection of children, a group of 12th century French nuns began distributing candy on St. Nicholas Day, December 6th. Soon it was believed that St. Nicholas himself was delivering the gifts of candy, leaving them in the shoes of good children. He left switches to intimidate the bad ones. All this adoration appalled the German reformer Martin Luther, who felt attention like this should be reserved for the Son of God alone. When Luther created Protestantism in the 16th century, St. Nicholas was one of the first figures he banned. But he knew some elements should stay.
One reason Lutheranism survived was that Luther was a very good marketer. And he knew that if he was going to wean Germany's children off of St. Nicholas, he was going to have to use some pretty powerful medicine. Well, what he chose for this was the Christkindl, the Christ child. The baby Jesus is a winged cherub flying around giving gifts. And the final element here, of course, is that Jesus comes on his own birthday, on Christmas Eve, not on St. Nicholas Day.
In America, the Christkindl would become Kris Kringle, another name for Santa Claus. But in many parts of Europe, it wasn't the Christ child who brought the presents. In England, it was Father Christmas who left gifts on Christmas Eve for excited children to discover in the morning. In France, this job was done by Père Noël. An old hag in Italy named Befana searched from house to house looking for the Christ child, leaving gifts for good children in her wake. In Sweden, the gifts were handed out by the gnome Jultomten. These traditions are still practiced in much of Europe, and neither time nor church dogma can lessen their appeal. But in Holland, it was St. Nicholas himself who gave the gifts, mostly because Dutch sailors refused to give up their patron saint. When Dutch explorers sailed for the New World, they naturally took St. Nicholas with them. They called him Sinterklaas, Dutch for St. Nicholas, and he remained exclusively part of Dutch culture here until America declared her independence in the Revolutionary War. Then we needed our own symbols, and anything that wasn't distinctly English was proudly touted as American.
Immediately after the Revolutionary War, things English were out of fashion in American life. We just fought a war against the English, and Americans wanted to get away from English culture, English fashion, English traditions. In New York City, this took the form of looking back to the city's Dutch past.
The country's first man of letters, Washington Irving, gave the Dutch Sinterklaas a prominent role in the Knickerbocker History, his hugely popular chronicle of New York. Irving mentions the good saint some 24 times and describes in detail the Dutch traditions of St. Nicholas Day. But this St. Nicholas was still primarily thought of as a saint. It took a poem written in 1823 by Clement Clark Moore, professor of classics at Columbia University, to change this forever. That poem is entitled A Visit from St. Nicholas, and in one fell swoop, the austere saint from Mira was gone, replaced by jolly St. Nick.
The story goes that he was out shopping for a turkey. He was inspired by the sound of the horses drawing his sleigh and by the driver. And he composed a poem in his head, and he read it to his family the next day.
What Moore read to his family is known to everyone now. Here are sections of the poem with the original color illustrations.
'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in hopes that St. Nicholas would soon be there. The children were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads. When out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I sprang from my bed to see what was the matter. When to my wondering eyes should appear but a miniature sleigh and 8 tiny reindeer. More rapid than eagles his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name. Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, on Comet, on Cupid, on Dunder and Blitzen. To the top of the porch, to the top of the wall, now dash away, dash away, dash away all. As I drew in my head and was turning around, down the chimney St. Nicholas came with a bound. His eyes, how they twinkled, his dimples, how merry. His cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry. He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly. And laying a finger aside of his nose and giving a nod, up the chimney he rose. But I heard him exclaim, merry, out of sight, Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night.
Moore's poem looked both forward and back. It was the bridge between St. Nicholas and the modern Santa Claus. When he wrote that St. Nicholas laid a finger aside his nose, he was lifting a line directly from Irving's Knickerbocker History. But Moore also added original touches to the Santa story.
We see Santa Claus described as plump, as a jolly elfin figure. He's no longer a Christian religious figure. He's much more pagan. That just almost comes out of thin air. We established the reindeer. We established the sleigh. We established definitely that he arrives by going up and down the chimney. Just so many aspects of the modern image of Santa Claus were all cast into stone once and for all by this one little poem that came into the national consciousness quite by accident.
Now known as 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, it is the most successful Christmas poem of all time. It's been translated into many other languages, and each culture leaves its own unique stamp. Old Sandy Claw is a version in the South Carolinian language of Gullah. Here, Santa arrives not on reindeer, but on a team of goats. There's even a Yiddish parody of the poem featuring Hiawatha as the expectant child.
The success of The Night Before Christmas touched off an explosion of popular literature about Santa Claus. For example, Mrs. Claus was invented by Catherine Lee Bates, who also wrote the words to America the Beautiful. Louisa May Alcott tried her hand at it. Everybody who was anybody and needed some money from getting writing published took a whack at Santa Claus. When a figure is this popular in literature, the next question is going to be, what does he look like? There were dozens of illustrators presenting all different kinds of visions, some of them looking very saint-like, some of them looking very pagan. It fell to Thomas Nast to tell America what Santa Claus really looked like.
Thomas Nast was the head editorial cartoonist for Harper's Weekly from 1860 to 1890. He's seen here in a whimsical self-portrait. Nast had a passion for drawing Santa Claus. With each rendition, he added new elements to Santa's story. Through his drawing of Santa at his telescope, we learned for the first time that Santa lived at the North Pole. Nast also gave us our first look at Santa's big book of good and bad children. And he even showed us Santa taking a Christmas wish over the newfangled telephone. For the first time, we had a picture of Santa's home life. So Santa Claus is born. Son of St. Nicholas, Woden, Clement Moore, and every child who ever dreamed of him on Christmas Eve. But as the 20th century approaches, Santa will be known not just for his generosity, but for his salesmanship as well.
There's Rudolph, and I think there's one named Dasher or something like that.
Well, Rudolph, Donner,
Rudolph, the red-nosed reindeer.
In the Middle Ages, the bishop's hat and staff of St. Nicholas evoked a powerful sense of mystery and protection. By the turn of the century, the hat had become a floppy one, and the staff a candy cane. These new images may not have been as powerful, but they quickly became just as popular. On Christmas Eve, 1891, President Benjamin Harrison told a newspaper reporter, "We shall have an old-fashioned Christmas tree for the grandchildren upstairs, and I shall be their Santa Claus myself. Let me hope that my example may be followed by every family in the land." Adults may have embraced Santa with open arms, but some children were a tougher sell. One such skeptic was 8-year-old Virginia O'Hanlon, who wrote a letter to the New York Sun newspaper in 1897.
Virginia penned the deathless phrase, "My daddy says if you see it in the sun, it's so," and asked, "Well, is there a Santa Claus?"
The Sun quickly printed a response, the best defense St. Nick has ever had. "Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus," the paper wrote. "He exists as certainly as love and generosity and devotion exist. Alas, how dreadful the world would be if there were no Santa Claus. It would be as if there were no Virginias. 1,000 years from now, he will continue to make glad the heart of childhood." By casting him as the embodiment of love and goodness, the Sun gave us the perfect argument for believing in Santa Claus. The idea of Santa may have been settled, but some of the particulars still needed some fine-tuning. In 1939, a copywriter at the Montgomery Ward department store was searching for a way to lure Christmas shoppers into the store. He came up with a children's book giveaway that featured Rudolph, a new reindeer who had a shiny red nose and a gift for navigation.
"Here is little Rudolph. The other reindeer look down on him because he's different. And yet, when it comes time to save Christmas, even Santa Claus requires Rudolph to save the day. Even the parents have to reach back to that little spirit of childhood and like, you too, little child, can save Christmas." And I think that's one of the reasons why it
Jack Perkins. Welcome to Biography. Father Christmas, Old St. Nick, Kris Kringle, these are some of the names given to the man anxiously awaited every December 24, the night before Christmas.
Well, it looks like we're having a little technical problems here. This little program is not working very good. Anyway, I just want to let everybody know if it's anyway, we are having problems here at the studios again. We always have problems at studios. So if y'all was joining me, just bear with me. We'll have to start back over with. I don't know what happened there. I'm not having any luck. We're just going to have to start the audio back over. So it'll be going over again. So
I'm Jack Perkins. Welcome to Biography. Father Christmas, Old Saint Nick, Kris Kringle, these are some of the names given to the man anxiously awaited every December 24, the night before Christmas. We all know him as Santa Claus. What we sometimes forget is that this jolly old elf who sneaks down the chimney every year has a history more than 1,700 years old, a tradition that spans the globe. He started as a bishop in Turkey, famed for his generosity to those in trouble. He was beloved patron saint of Europe who sailed to America with the Dutch. Once here, he transformed from Saint Nicholas to Santa Claus, a gentleman synonymous with Christmas, with bringing families together, with filling children with anticipation, and of course, with helping to sell a lot of products around December 25. Join us as we take a look back across hundreds of years to trace the extraordinary history of Santa Claus.
Merry Christmas, everybody!
Better watch out, you better not cry, better not pout, I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town, gather round.
He has a big list and a telescope.
He goes to the chimney. Mommy and Daddy stay downstairs and give him cookies.
A red suit, flying reindeer, ho ho ho. These are the well-known particulars of Santa Claus, alias Father Christmas, Old Saint Nick, Kris Kringle. But who is he, and where did he come from? Well, he's taken a long journey from 3rd century Turkey to medieval France, and finally to every department store in America.
You better watch out, you better not cry, you better not cry, I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming.
You mean the big fat man with the long white beard?
He's coming to town.
He now seems timeless. But in fact, Santa has a long and surprisingly colorful past. The story begins some 1,700 years ago. In the heart of the Roman Empire, in a town in Turkey called Patara. There, a real-life boy named Nicholas was born to wealthy Christian parents who had tried to have a child for years. And right from the start, the boy was remarkably holy. Wednesdays and Fridays were fast days for Christians. On these days, it is said little Nicholas would only nurse after sundown.
As a baby, precocious, he was able to stand up in his little bassinet early on. These, you know, little touches, legendary touches, are all very charming. We don't know them as historical fact because nobody was around to take videotapes, you know, of a little, little Nicky.
The holy young man quickly rose from deacon to local priest. When he was 30 years old, the local diocese of Mira needed a new leader. The outgoing bishop received a sign from God about Nicholas.
That night, that very righteous bishop saw an image of a man at the back of the church. His face was like transfigured. He was bright like the sun. And he asked, "Who am I seeing? Who is this?" And he heard an angel say to him, "This is the next bishop that you should elect for Myra. His name is Nicholas."
Sure enough, Nicholas became the Bishop of Myra. And it is as the bishop that he earned a worldwide reputation as a righter of wrongs, a protector of the innocent. One early legend has Nicholas learning that a neighbor did not have a dowry for his oldest daughter. In the 4th century, this meant the girl would be sold off into prostitution or slavery. So Nicholas took some of his own family's gold, tied it into a handkerchief, and secretly dropped it through the neighbor's window. The girl was saved from her dreadful fate.
in many versions of the story, the gold landed in her stocking. You know, people would hang their socks out in front of the fireplace to dry. So this is where we get the idea of the gifts in the Christmas stocking.
When Nicholas repeated the gifts of gold for the neighbor's other two daughters, stories of his generosity began to spread. People spoke of his late-night anonymous gifts and his granting of secret wishes, just what the later Santa Claus would do. Nicholas was also gaining fame as a staunch defender of the faith, which he proved at an important early Christian council in Nicaea in 314.
The great element of St. Nicholas's presence at the Council of Nicaea is that it confirms his actual existence. There was a list of participants, and here was St. Nicholas of Myra present.
Led by Emperor Constantine, the council ceaselessly debated whether Christ was divine. Nicholas had no doubt of it, and he argued passionately. But one bishop refused to be moved by his arguments.
Nicholas, caught up in righteous anger, just couldn't find words anymore after months of meeting. So he just went up and he just slapped him. Everyone, of course, just looked and said, "Oh."
Protector of maidens, protector of the faith, the Bishop of Myra was soon called Saint Nicholas by those who heard of his miracles. And he was called upon by practically all who found themselves in trouble, lawyers and their clients, unmarried and childless women, and even pawnbrokers invoked this powerful figure. Sailors also called St. Nicholas their patron, believing he could appear from nowhere and calm a turbulent sea. But St. Nicholas achieved his greatest fame as the patron saint of the most vulnerable among us, children. In perhaps the most famous miracle associated with St. Nicholas, three students were on their way to school and were brutally kidnapped, robbed, and dismembered by an evil innkeeper. The innkeeper then stuffed the students' remains into empty pickle barrels. Well, suddenly, St. Nicholas appeared at the inn and commanded the boys to arise from the barrels. Slowly, miraculously, they emerged intact.
Here we have St. Nicholas, the beautiful patron saint of those otherwise lost and forgotten, never to be found children, who appears on the spot and piece by piece calls them out of the barrel and are brought back to life by the righteous St. Nicholas.
When Nicholas died on December 6, 343, his body was laid to rest in a tomb in Myra. Legend has it that the tomb began leaking a viscous liquid perfumed with myrrh, and that one drop of this liquid could heal the most troubling sickness.
People came there, blind, lame, people who suffered from all kinds of fevers, diseases. It was just as the scripture said. The blind see, the lame walk, the paralyzed are being freed. And myrrh healed so many, many people.
The body of St. Nicholas was a holy treasure coveted by the entire Christian world. In 1082, during the Crusades, it was removed from Myra and taken to Bari, Italy by a band of sailors.
He was, in fact, snatched and kidnapped. But one man's snatching and kidnapping is another man's liberation. So he was taken to Bari, and there's a beautiful cathedral in Bari, which was built around St. Nicholas.
Each year, the residents of Bari restage the arrival of their most famous resident. The 11th century sailors of Bari carried stories of their miraculous Nicholas around the world, and the saint's promise of protection and mercy was irresistible. Saint Nick soon becomes the most popular saint of the Middle Ages, setting the stage for his next great transformation to Santa Claus.
Now, where does Santa Claus live?
North Pole.
North Pole.
His beard is white, his mustache is white, and his hair is white.
What does Santa look like?
He looks like Santa Claus.
The vast public appeal of the stories of St. Nicholas was largely religious, but mixed in were features of pagan gods and goddesses. The most important of these pagan gods was the German god Woden, pictured here as an 11th century statue. Woden, it was said, would pass judgment on a village by flying overhead and seeing whether the villagers were taking care of their family, their farms, their animals.
So we're starting to see already some elements that will come down to us in later pictures of St. Nicholas and many of the early pictures of Santa Claus. We have the mystical rider who comes through the sky and visits every home in the community. We have the judge who looks at your record for the whole year and decides whether you've been bad or good.
By combining the power of ancient gods like Woden with Christian miracles, St. Nicholas became an extraordinarily powerful and popular saint. By the Middle Ages, there were more churches named after this zealous crusader than there were for all the apostles put together.
St. Nicholas was enormously popular during the Middle Ages. He was the third figure in Christianity after Christ and the Mother of God. He was somebody you'd have around because you needed him. So he was a conduit to heaven. The most familiar, spokesman for your needs.
Inspired by his miracles, and especially by his protection of children, a group of 12th century French nuns began distributing candy on St. Nicholas Day, December 6th. Soon it was believed that St. Nicholas himself was delivering the gifts of candy, leaving them in the shoes of good children. He left switches to intimidate the bad ones. All this adoration appalled the German reformer Martin Luther, who felt attention like this should be reserved for the Son of God alone. When Luther created Protestantism in the 16th century, St. Nicholas was one of the first figures he banned. But he knew some elements should stay.
One reason Lutheranism survived was that Luther was a very good marketer. And he knew that if he was going to wean Germany's children off of St. Nicholas, he was going to have to use some pretty powerful medicine. Well, what he chose for this was the Christkindl, the Christ child. The baby Jesus is a winged cherub flying around giving gifts. And the final element here, of course, is that Jesus comes on his own birthday, on Christmas Eve, not on St. Nicholas Day.
In America, the Christkindl would become Kris Kringle, another name for Santa Claus. But in many parts of Europe, it wasn't the Christ child who brought the presents. In England, it was Father Christmas who left gifts on Christmas Eve for excited children to discover in the morning. In France, this job was done by Père Noël. An old hag in Italy named Befana searched from house to house looking for the Christ child, leaving gifts for good children in her wake. In Sweden, the gifts were handed out by the gnome Jultomten. These traditions are still practiced in much of Europe, and neither time nor church dogma can lessen their appeal. But in Holland, it was St. Nicholas himself who gave the gifts, mostly because Dutch sailors refused to give up their patron saint. When Dutch explorers sailed for the New World, they naturally took St. Nicholas with them. They called him Sinterklaas, Dutch for St. Nicholas. And he remained exclusively part of Dutch culture here until America declared her independence in the Revolutionary War. Then we needed our own symbols, and anything that wasn't distinctly English was proudly touted as American.
Immediately after the Revolutionary War, things English were out of fashion in American life. We just fought a war against the English, and Americans wanted to get away from English culture, English fashion, English traditions. In New York City, this took the form of looking back to the city's Dutch past.
The country's first man of letters, Washington Irving, gave the Dutch Sinterklaas a prominent role in the Knickerbocker History, his hugely popular chronicle of New York. Irving mentions the good saint some 24 times and describes in detail the Dutch traditions of St. Nicholas Day. But this St. Nicholas was still primarily thought of as a saint. It took a poem written in 1823 by Clement Clark Moore, professor of classics at Columbia University, to change this forever. That poem is entitled A Visit from St. Nicholas. And in one fell swoop, the austere saint from Mira was gone, replaced by jolly St. Nick.
The story goes that he was out shopping for a turkey. He was inspired by the sound of the horses drawing his sleigh and by the driver. And he composed a poem in his head and he read it to his family the next day.
What Moore read to his family is known to everyone now. Here are sections of the poem with the original color illustrations.
'Twas the night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in hopes that St. Nicholas would soon be there. The children were nestled all snug in their beds, while visions of sugar plums danced in their heads. When out on the lawn there arose such a clatter, I sprang from my bed to see what was the matter. When to my wondering eyes should appear but a miniature sleigh and 8 tiny reindeer. More rapid than eagles his coursers they came, and he whistled and shouted and called them by name. Now Dasher, now Dancer, now Prancer and Vixen, on Comet, on Cupid, on Donder and Blitzen. To the top of the porch, to the top of the wall, now dash away, dash away, dash away all. As I drew in my head and was turning around, down the chimney St. Nicholas came with a bound. His eyes, how they twinkled, his dimples, how merry. His cheeks were like roses, his nose like a cherry. He had a broad face and a little round belly that shook when he laughed like a bowl full of jelly. And laying a finger aside of his nose and giving a nod, up the chimney he rose. But I heard him exclaim ere he was out of sight, "Happy Christmas to all, and to all a good night."
Moore's poem looked both forward and back. It was the bridge between St. Nicholas and the modern Santa Claus. When he wrote that St. Nicholas laid a finger aside his nose, he was lifting a line directly from Irving's Knickerbocker History. But Moore also added original touches to the Santa story.
We see Santa Claus described as plump, as a jolly elfin figure. He's no longer a Christian religious figure. He's much more pagan. That just almost comes out of thin air. We established the reindeer. We established the sleigh. We established definitely that he arrives by going up and down the chimney. Just so many aspects of the modern image of Santa Claus were all cast into stone once and for all by this one little poem that came into the national consciousness quite by accident.
Now known as 'Twas the Night Before Christmas, it is the most successful Christmas poem of all time. It's been translated into many other languages, and each culture leaves its own unique stamp. Old Sandy Claw is a version in the South Carolinian language of Gullah. Here, Santa arrives not on reindeer, but on a team of goats. There's even a Yiddish parody of the poem featuring Hiawatha as the expectant child.
The success of The Night Before Christmas touched off an explosion of popular literature about Santa Claus. For example, Mrs. Claus was invented by Catherine Lee Bates, who also wrote the words to America the Beautiful. Louisa May Alcott tried her hand at it. Everybody who was anybody and needed some money from getting writing published took a whack at Santa Claus. When a figure is this popular in literature, the next question is going to be, what does he look like? There were dozens of illustrators presenting all different kinds of visions, some of them looking very saint-like, some of them looking very pagan. It fell to Thomas Nast to tell America what Santa Claus really looked like.
Thomas Nast was the head editorial cartoonist for Harper's Weekly from 1860 to 1890. He's seen here in a whimsical self-portrait. Nast had a passion for drawing Santa Claus. With each rendition, he added new elements to Santa's story. Through his drawing of Santa at his telescope, we learned for the first time that Santa lived at the North Pole. Nast also gave us our first look at Santa's big book of good and bad children. And he even showed us Santa taking a Christmas wish over the newfangled telephone. For the first time, we had a picture of Santa's home life. So Santa Claus is born. Son of St. Nicholas, Woden, Clement Moore, and every child who ever dreamed of him on Christmas Eve. But as the 20th century approaches, Santa will be known not just for his generosity, but for his salesmanship as well.
There's Rudolph, and I think there's one named Dasher, something like that.
Well, Rudolph, Donner,
Rudolph, the red-nosed reindeer.
In the Middle Ages, the bishop's hat and staff of St. Nicholas evoked a powerful sense of mystery and protection. By the turn of the century, the hat had become a floppy one, and the staff, a candy cane. These new images may not have been as powerful, but they quickly became just as popular. On Christmas Eve, 1891, President Benjamin Harrison told a newspaper reporter, "We shall have an old-fashioned Christmas tree for the grandchildren upstairs, and I shall be their Santa Claus myself. Let me hope that my example may be followed by every family in the land." Adults may have embraced Santa with open arms, but some children were a tougher sell. One such skeptic was 8-year-old Virginia O'Hanlon, who wrote a letter to the New York Sun newspaper in 1897.
Virginia penned the deathless phrase, "My daddy says if you see it in the sun, it's so," and asked, "Well, is there a Santa Claus?"
The Sun quickly printed a response, the best defense St. Nick has ever had. "Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus," the paper wrote. "He exists as certainly as love and generosity and devotion exist. Alas, how dreadful the world would be if there were no Santa Claus. It would be as if there were no Virginias. 1,000 years from now, he will continue to make glad the heart of childhood." By casting him as the embodiment of love and goodness, the Sun gave us the perfect argument for believing in Santa Claus. The idea of Santa may have been settled, but some of the particulars still needed some fine-tuning. In 1939, a copywriter at the Montgomery Ward department store was searching for a way to lure Christmas shoppers into the store. He came up with a children's book giveaway that featured Rudolph, a new reindeer who had a shiny red nose and a gift for navigation.
Here is little Rudolph. The other reindeer look down on him because he's different. And yet, when it comes time to save Christmas, even Santa Claus requires Rudolph to save the day. Even the parents have to reach back to that little spirit of childhood and like, you too, little child, can save Christmas. And I think that's one of the reasons why it
Well, here we come to the kind of silent part of the show due to when we were recording the show kind of went blank on us for a little bit, so just stay tuned. When the show will continue here in just a little bit. I really don't know how long the gap is, but anyway, hoping everybody's enjoying the show, and just stay tuned, and the show will continue here in just a little bit.
Why do the same glasses cost so much less on GlassesUSA.com than at the store? The thing is...
On Christmas Eve, 1891, President Benjamin Harrison told a newspaper reporter, "We shall have an old-fashioned Christmas tree for the grandchildren upstairs, and I shall be their Santa Claus myself. Let me hope that my example may be followed by every family in the land." Adults may have embraced Santa with open arms, but some children were a tougher sell. One such skeptic was 8-year-old Virginia O'Hanlon, who wrote a letter to the New York Sun newspaper in 1897.
Virginia penned the deathless phrase, "My daddy says if you see it in the sun, it's so," and asked, "Well, is there a Santa Claus?"
The Sun quickly printed a response, the best defense St. Nick has ever had. "Yes, Virginia, there is a Santa Claus," the paper wrote. "He exists as certainly as love and generosity and devotion exist. Alas, how dreadful the world would be if there were no Santa Claus. It would be as if there were no Virginias. 1,000 years from now, he will continue to make glad the heart of childhood." By casting him as the embodiment of love and goodness, the Sun gave us the perfect argument for believing in Santa Claus. The idea of Santa may have been settled, but some of the particulars still needed some fine-tuning. In 1939, a copywriter at the Montgomery Ward department store was searching for a way to lure Christmas shoppers into the store. He came up with a children's book giveaway that featured Rudolph, a new reindeer who had a shiny red nose and a gift for navigation.
Here is little Rudolph. The other reindeer look down on him because he's different. And yet, when it comes time to save Christmas, even Santa Claus requires Rudolph to save the day. Even the parents have to reach back to that little spirit of childhood and like, you too, little child, can save Christmas. And I think that's one of the reasons why it was as effective as it was and why it was received into the canon so quickly.
Santa Claus himself went through one final facelift. In 1930, Coca-Cola hired an illustrator named Haddon Sunblom to draw a series of advertisements starring Santa. Instead of the small, gnome-like Santa of Thomas Nast's drawings, Sunblom's Santa was tall, rotund, and unflaggingly jolly. An unlikely combination of grandfather and superhero. And this Coca-Cola Santa is the Santa we all know, though someday that too may change.
You know, somewhere out there is the next Clement Moore, the next Thomas Nast, who's going to work some new variation on the Santa Claus lore, and then people are going to grow up thinking it's always been like that.
What probably won't change is his spectacular ability to sell. An appealing Santa, appealing for your business. How could you resist?
Santa baby, just slip a sable under the tree for me. Been an awful good girl, Santa baby, so hurry down the chimney tonight.
I mean, let's look at Santa Claus. We have Santa Claus, who is all over the place, standing and telling people, buy this for yourself. Get this for yourself. Get this for someone you love and what have you. It has nothing to do with need. It has nothing to do with holiness. And it really has very little to do with giving it to people who don't have.
Sure, it's commercial. I mean, it's a time of the year when lots of businesses have to sell things if they're going to continue to pay wages to their employees. And I don't see there's anything wrong with that. And I don't see how buying and selling at Christmas time interferes with the spirituality of it.
Hello up there.
Hello, Bob. Merry Christmas.
I imagine you're pretty busy.
Right up to my beard, Bob.
What seems to be leading the gift lists this year, Santa?
Elgin Petite Watches.
All right, Santa, work with me. Work to the camera.
We had to work real hard to get just the right look for our Carvel Santa Claus ice cream cake. Buy one now and get four little elves for only $4 more.
I think that the symbolisms that we develop are often for the better. The teddy bear has redressed the image of the bear for whole civilization. It's no longer been taken as a grizzly that is going to eat you up. Mickey Mouse has done more for mice than any public relations firm could do. So by being facetious and also being very serious, Santa Claus is in essence an image of goodness, not necessarily of spending money foolishly.
And besides, for many of us, it's not Santa the salesman we love best anyway. It's a movie Santa we carry in our hearts every Christmas.
Your Honor, we request an immediate ruling from this court. Is there or is there not a Santa Claus?
The court will take a short recess to consider the matter.
Have you ever left food out for Santa?
Mm-hmm. Once I left him water, peanut butter, and celery and carrots.
Cookies.
Some cookies.
Cookies and milk. He's fat.
He's fat? How'd he get so fat?
For eating those cookies and milk.
Santa Claus has always had great star quality, and the movies took notice right from the start. In fact, his cinematic debut goes back to this rare film from 1903. It's all here. The outfit. The reindeer. The toys. And a Santa with a very long lens who knows exactly who's been nice. Or who's been naughty? As the movies grew, so did Santa's stardom. His biggest role was unquestionably in the 1947 Miracle on 34th Street. In this Christmas classic, the state of New York drags him into court for asserting he's the real Santa.
What is your name?
Kris Kringle.
Where do you live?
That's what this hearing will decide.
Do you believe that you're Santa Claus?
Of
course.
When the U.S. Post Office officially delivers Santa's mail to him at the courthouse, the judge has no choice but to rule in his favor.
Since the United States government declares this man to be Santa Claus, this court will not dispute it. Case dismissed.
The newsreels also went crazy over Santa, featuring his yearly arrival, however he showed up, as a very big deal.
What do you want, honey?
A puppy dog and a baby brother.
You better watch out, you better not cry, better not pout, I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming to town, gather round. He's making a list, checking it twice, gonna find out who's a naughty and nice. Santa Claus is coming to town.
But to most of us, Santa's most familiar roles have been in Christmas cartoons. He's been a cartoon hero for almost as long as cartoons have been around.
Dasher, Dancer, Prancer, Vixen, Comet, Cupid, Donner, Blitzen.
Every once a year when Christmas comes, I pack my sled with dolls and drums, and I'm on my way with happiness for little girls and boys.
Some Santa cartoons are as welcome an annual visitor as Santa himself. There's his biography.
I can see them when they're sleeping. I know when they're awake.
My goodness. You know if they're bad or good?
So you tell them to be good. For goodness sake.
Oh, thank you, Chris.
For what?
For being so kind. For just being you.
Golly.
And that anti-Santa, the Grinch.
The Grinch hated Christmas the whole Christmas season. Now, please don't ask why. No one quite knows the reason. It could be, perhaps, that his shoes were too tight. It could be his head wasn't screwed on just right. But I think that the most likely reason of all may have been that his heart was two sizes too small.
Put a constant guard on Santa and the Earth Children. Voldar will be back.
On the big screen, Santa has made some odd career choices. In 1964, an ill-advised marriage of sci-fi and Saint Nick produced Santa Claus Conquers the Martians.
What to find out? The toy shop is operating full blast.
Two dolls.
Two dolls, yes, Betty.
The story itself is as old-fashioned as you can get. Gentle Santa brings the spirit of Christmas to Earthlings and Martians alike. But when Santa strays too far from his kindly image, the public won't stand for it.
You've made it through Halloween. Now try and survive Christmas.
Because of protests, Silent Night, Deadly Night was pulled from the theaters within a few weeks of opening.
I think we should have the movie out before Santa don't go around killing people.
It is a symbol, however, of goodwill and love, and I think to desecrate that is a problem, particularly for young children.
We seem to prefer it when Santa's more like Santa, as he is in the 1994 remake of Miracle on 34th Street. Co-starring with Santa in this film is newcomer Mara Wilson.
Bye-bye, darling.
Good. Oh, he come.
You're a very good Santa Claus.
Thank you.
Your beard stuck on real tight. Usually the store Santa Claus whiskers are too loose.
Right.
Yours look realistic.
That's because they are real. You give them a tug.
I think this movie is about having faith in someone that can take care of you. like your mother or your father or Santa Claus or the Tooth Fairy or God?
Faith. That's what Santa's story gives us. And each Christmas, we get to experience it anew.
You can't repress Santa Claus because he's such a great story. He's remarkably durable. He's lasted, well, at least 1,000 years and more. And there have been a number of attempts to do away with him. He just laughs and gets back on his sleigh and his reindeer and rides off in the snow.
Pretty close.
How does Santa get in the house?
Chimney. He goes in the chimney.
Well, since the doors are locked, he goes down the chimney.
I don't know how he gets through with from not getting, like, stinged and getting burned by the fire.
Today, the only three-dimensional Santa most kids see is at the local department store, where legions of Santa's helpers play the big man during the Christmas season.
I want my bicycle and a hat and a helmet.
The department store Santa has been around for almost as long as modern Santa himself. The first was James Edgar, a store owner in Brockton, Massachusetts. Edgar had tried dressing up as clowns, war heroes, even Uncle Sam. But when in 1890 he impersonated Santa Claus, kids flocked to his store. Today, when Santa is busy at the North Pole, he calls on these well-trained stand-ins.
You have a Merry Christmas.
Many of them learn their craft at Western Temporary Services, a San Francisco temp agency that teaches people how to become the jolly gentleman.
The name of the reindeer are...
Dasher, Dancer, Prancer, Vixen, Comet, Cupid.
Some of the most common don'ts that we ask Santa not to do are like no smoking, no flirting, no drinking. Those are some of the things that he might naturally do without even thinking. Flirting, I think it's been obvious over the years that you may have seen Santas who actually, you know, that ho, 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 dirty old man type of phrase, which, you know, it's kind of ugly, but it has been true in the past.
I've been Santa for...
And then there, of course, is Santa's personal hygiene. When children are so close, they are going to probably pick up on maybe some bad breath or garlicky foods. And as close as the kids get, they'll blurt right out, Mommy, you know, Santa smells.
The accessory kit has the beard, the wig, the white gloves.
Here comes Santa Claus, here comes Santa Claus, right down Santa Claus Lane. He'll come around when times ring out, it's Christmas time again. Peace on earth will come to all if we just follow the light. So let's give thanks to the Lord above, cause Santa Claus comes tonight. Here comes Santa Claus. Here comes Santa Claus.
We gotta help Brian with his ho ho ho.
Ho 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 ho.
Merry Christmas, Santa.
Merry Christmas to you, Santa.
People want to touch Santa more and photograph Santa more than anyone else that I know. I mean, I think he's just the biggest star there is.
Santa has become such a big star that the fortunes of his ancestor, St. Nicholas, have been almost forgotten. In fact, in 1969, the Roman Catholic Church ruled that St. Nicholas, along with a number of other saints, was never officially canonized. The celebration of his feast day was therefore ruled optional to the world's Catholics. But Nicholas is still highly venerated in the Greek Orthodox tradition, and it is here that his spirit is most alive. In 1972, some of the relics of St. Nicholas were transferred to the St. Nicholas Church in Flushing, New York, the largest single Greek Orthodox church in the United States. Here there is a reliquary dedicated to these holy remains.
In here, we will find, first, a container which has a bit of the myrrh which was exuding from the very bones of St. Nicholas, from his relics. Here we have a piece from his casket. Again, this is not to be taken lightly. This is a profound honor for our church. Here we have a piece, both of his clothing, of his vestment, and inside this piece, there is a piece of his skull. Inside the brown area is a piece of his skull. I am very, very grateful to be a priest and serve an altar which is first and foremost dedicated to Christ and certainly in the memory of St. Nicholas.
Whether he was ever canonized or not, the idea of St. Nicholas was perfect for his time. Tough and crusading, he protected a frightened world from the ravages around it. Today, Santa Claus works some powerful magic in our turbulent world.
I think that the protective image that St. Nicholas projected originally, it remains to a certain degree with Santa Claus today, because we are in need of such a protective power in this day when we feel so vulnerable. So the protective solidity, the belief that there is an underlying justice, that is what the St. Nicholas Santa Claus image projects.
Santa protects us from ever becoming too grown up, from forgetting about the wonder, generosity, and magic of life we celebrate at Christmas.
Santa Claus is a wonderful story, a true story with a capital T, of God's love for us and of our parents' love for us and of the wonders of Christmas time. Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good night.
Over hill and dale again this year, I brought glad tidings and a good cheer. So until another Christmas Day, when I pay another call, I'll say Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas to all! Merry Christmas to all!
Christmas morning. The cookies left out for Santa are gone. The glass of milk is empty. Children around the world open presents left behind by the midnight visitor. Then, thoughts of Santa fade for another year. But come next winter, a new set of lists will be mailed off to the North Pole, and children will sit in Santa's lap and whisper their wishes into his ear all over again. And they will hope that they've been good enough so that Santa will remember them again at Christmas.
Well, I hope everybody enjoyed the show of History of Santa Claus. We'll be back on the air tomorrow from noon to 2. We'll be talking about haunted places in Arkansas, number 2. We started haunted Arkansas last weekend. So y'all stay tuned to tomorrow when we will be back on the air at noon to 2 to do another show for you. So everybody be safe out there. If you got winter weather in your area, watch those roads in the mornings, and hopefully they're not iced over. Hopefully the stuff will move out and everything kind of dry off before then. But if not, y'all be safe. This is Tapping, the Arkansas Paranormal Network, coming to you from Van Buren, Arkansas. And everybody have a good night, and we'll see you tomorrow.